And yet, when faced with huge amounts of evidence of something that will have devastating consequences, they're pretty relaxed. You know, so, yeah, okay, yeah, whatever. So it gets a bit warmer. You know, if we're in a cold part of the world, that would be quite nice. Be all right. We can live with that. Unfortunately, it is rather more serious. As the NASA climate scientist James Hansen and colleagues put it, continued growth of greenhouse gas emissions for just another decade practically eliminates the possibility of near-term return of atmospheric composition beneath the tipping level for catastrophic effects. Now, this is a manifestly solvable problem. We know what the problem is. We know how to fix it. We could fix it tomorrow if we wanted, but we don't. And the reason why we don't is because consumer capitalism makes it very difficult for us to do that for two reasons. One, consumer capitalism is not very good at thinking in the medium or the long term. So because the effects of climate change usually take a few decades to manifest themselves, I mean, the span of human history, that's not very long. But for consumer capitalism, that's way too long to really plan for or think ahead. The other problem with consumer capitalism here is that one of the solutions to climate change is something it simply cannot comprehend. One of the solutions is that we start to consume less. And that's something that consumer capitalism just says, hang on, you know, what? No, it just doesn't compute. Don't understand. That's not something that we can do. That's just simply not possible within these systems.
You're listening to Justin Lewis on consumer capitalism. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
So climate change, from that point of view, it's a function of living in a finite world, but it's beyond the philosophical imagination of a system premised on infinite growth. So, just to sum up the problems. Consumer capitalism has become economically incoherent. It's no longer capable of making us healthier or happier, and it risks jeopardizing the ecosystems on which we depend. So we should ask, at this point, what would a happier, more fulfilling model of society, what would a better model of progress look like? But we're too busy consuming to even ask the question. So what's the problem here? Why don't we start to think about other models? Well, the reason, I think, has to do with our media and communications industries. And I want to just mention three of them today. And the first of them has to do with the way in which our media and consumer communications industries are structured around certain kinds of commercial imperatives and certain kinds of business models. This is an industry that's very important economically. It's about 7% of global economic activity. That's a pretty big chunk for a sector. And that's growing. It's growing at a faster rate than most other sectors. But much more important than that, this is a sector that dominates our waking hours. This is a sector like no other. This is a sector that has a command over our attention that no other sector gets close to. People in the United States spend around 68 hours a week consuming media. That's a long time. That's more time than we're likely to spend doing the other two things that dominate our lives, which is working or sleeping. You know, 50 or 100 years ago, you'd say that humans on the whole, most of them do two things, adults. They work and then they sleep and then they do a bunch of other things. Now we'd say they work, they sleep, they consume media, and then there's not really a lot of time left for anything else. So this has become a fundamental part of life today. The way the industry operates, therefore, is very important because it's likely to have a greater impact on the way we think than other industries are. Now, you know, there could be major breakthroughs that could take us a kind of a great leap forward, but it's not in their interest to do that. It's in their interests to do things in a way that maximizes their business opportunity. And as a result, they are in the vanguard of something that we call planned or built-in obsolescence. The idea that to be as profitable as possible means producing something that will become useless as quickly as possible. And the quicker you can do that, the more this thing becomes obsolete quickly, the more money you will make, because you can keep on selling it to us over and over and over again. It's a business model that this industry, above all others, has become fantastically skilled at. It has a genius for built-in obsolescence. So companies like Apple, that have a real flair for this thing, now operate on the principle that everything that Apple produces, they will be working to make sure that it needs to be replaced in a period of 12 to 18 months, so that you'll buy the next thing and keep on buying the next thing. As Jonathan Stern put it, this is an industry in which obsolescence is not only planned, but forced and engineered. And there are many, many examples of that. You just think about many of the sort of changes that we've seen in technology. So, for example, the change when we move from vinyl to CD. We move from vinyl to CD not because people said, we want CDs, they're better than vinyl. That's not why it happened. It happened because the industry realized there was money to be made in switching the technology on which people listen to music. One, you could sell people new stuff, so you could sell them CD players. Two, you could sell them the music they already had all over again. It's a very nice business model. Remarkably, we now see CDs becoming obsolete and vinyl making a comeback. In fact, sales of vinyl have gone up year on year over the last few years. And in fact, the head of the recorded music group at Warner Music Group, one of the biggest music groups in the world, suggested that, and I quote, "Vinyl will definitely outlast CDs because of the resonance, the sound." Now, this from an industry that said, forget about vinyl, it's all about CDs. Now, what that tells you is that it's not really about progress, it's about change, and changing as often as possible. And it doesn't really matter whether the change is an improvement or not. All that really matters is that you make the change. And you can see that in every place you look. Phones. I mean, phones. I remember when phones, the style of a phone, was emblematic of a whole decade. So, you know, you'd see a movie from the 1960s and there'd be a phone in it. And you'd think, yep, that's a 1960s phone. That phone, you know, speaks to the style of the 1960s. The average life of a phone now is 12 to 18 months. And the vast majority of the phones that we throw away are in perfect working order when we get rid of them. So we've gone from a period of replacement that was around a decade to one that's around 12 to 18 months. Computers. Computers are based on a principle of a kind of symbiotic relationship between software and hardware, which requires us to upgrade them. And usually upgrading one requires you to upgrade the other. So you have to buy new computers for the software, new software for the computers, and so on and so on. Now, early on, you know, the upgrades really were an upgrade. So, yeah, this is definitely better than what I had before. But I suspect most of you, the last time you experienced an upgrade, didn't feel that. I certainly didn't. I thought, okay, right, this is a bit annoying. I've got to learn all the things I used to be able to do in a new way. And it's different, but it's not obviously better. It's just a change. I went to a talk a couple of months ago with somebody from government whose job it was to use new technologies to deliver public services in a way that improved people's quality of life, in a way. He said he went to a meeting. He was a real enthusiast for the technology. And he said he went to a meeting with some of the leaders in the industry, with Apple and Microsoft and others. And they asked him, they said to him, what could we do for you? What would be the piece of advice you would give us? And he said, three words. Please slow down. You know, I spent all my time worrying about the next upgrade, about all the stuff I'm going to have to chuck out and replace, and the amount of money that's going to cost me, that I don't really have time to think about the socially useful aspects of the technology. I need the time and space and help to do that. But that was not the business model that they were working with. Now, all this has a huge environmental cost. Just take one device, video game consoles. Just one electronic device. In the United States, video game consoles collectively consume electricity at the same rate as the entire city of San Diego. That's the ninth largest city in the US. One device. And actually, that's not the real problem here. The amount of electricity they consume when we're running them is not the main environmental problem, because actually these devices consume four times as much resource in their production as they do in their use. So the real problem here is not their lack of energy efficiency when we use them, it's the fact that we keep replacing them. And the more often we do it, the worse it becomes. And we certainly are doing it pretty often. The average US household spends over $1,400 a year on a total of 500 million consumer electronic devices every year. The US Consumer Electronics Association suggested that global spending on consumer technology devices surpassed $1 trillion in 2012. Now, this is very resource-intensive activity. I mean, the average computer and monitor uses huge resources in its production. It requires something like 530 pounds of fossil fuels to produce it, 50 pounds of chemicals, and 3,300 pounds of water. That's roughly the same resources you need to produce an SUV every time you get a new computer. And if you have a system that says computers will last you five years if you're lucky, then you are on a very damaging environmental course. But the main problem here, I think, is an ideological one. That because this is an industry that dominates our sort of waking hours, the way it operates has an effect on the way we think about progress. And what I would suggest is that this industry has encouraged us to think that human progress is all about the replacement of commodities. That if we're not chucking the old thing away and buying something new as often as possible, then we're not progressing. That's how we think about it. We don't think about, well, progress is what we do with the objects. You know, progress is if the objects make our lives more fulfilling, make us smarter, mean that we know more. That's what progress would look like, we could say, but that's not the model that we're given. And indeed, this huge proliferation of electronic devices has had zero impact on how smart we are, what we know, and our happiness and the meaning of our lives. No impact at all. Now, we should say, well, hang on, if that's true, maybe we're doing it wrong. You know, we should be becoming more knowledgeable. We should be having our cultural horizons lifted. If it's not doing that, we're doing something wrong. But the model doesn't encourage us to ask that question. The second problem is to do with our dominant cultural industry. The Disney Corporation used the term, you may have heard of it, the Imagineer. Disney Imagineers. They're people who sculpt and construct imaginative landscapes for the Disney Corporation. We have created a culture in which our principal Imagineers are in the advertising industry. It's the greatest concentration of creative talent and energy that we have. And it's grown hugely over the last 100 and especially the last 50 years. Now, the irony, of course, is the more stuff we have, the more we need it. So, you know, advertising in the developed world has to work harder and harder the more we have. So it has grown at a faster and faster rate. Global advertising spending grew from $7.5 billion in 1950 to $72 billion by the end of the 1970s. By the end of 2011, we were spending $500 billion a year, most of it in the wealthy developed world, on advertising, trying to persuade people to buy more stuff. Now, that is a mammoth cultural effort, one that dwarfs other kinds of cultural efforts that we make. So the amount we spend on advertising is 15 times the size of the global box office of all films produced in a given year. 15 times bigger. It's a massive concentration of artistic energy. We have chosen to make our dominant cultural industry the industry that produces precisely that state of wanting. And it's everywhere. It has transformed every cultural industry that we can think of. Take the internet. I mean, I remember my colleague, Michael Morgan, who's here, when the internet first began to develop, the World Wide Web, showing me how it worked and saying, this is fantastic public space that's just been created, where all this information can be exchanged. This massive public sphere has been created. And it is remarkable. But in the space of a very short time, the internet has become mainly, economically, a way of delivering audiences to advertisers in increasingly sophisticated ways. And any of you that know about the way that things like Facebook work will know how sophisticated that has become. But that's mainly what it's about. That's mainly where it's funded from. For it's not funded by public money, it's funded by advertising. Television. Television, in some countries, television began as a medium that had no advertising at all. In my own country, in Britain, when television began, there was no advertising on it. Now, in countries like Britain, there has been a proliferation of channels, and most of them have more advertising on than they have ever had. There's more advertising on American television than there has ever been at any point in the history of American broadcasting. Recent surveys suggest that 41% of viewing time is taken up by advertising on American television. You know, the dominant genre on American television is not sitcoms, it's not reality TV, it's not sport, it's advertising by a mile. I'll come back to that in a moment. I mean, take other film, the film industry. I mean, films used to be ad-free. Now, there's not a film that comes out of Hollywood that doesn't have a slew of product placement deals, or that it isn't itself a vehicle for selling products. Witness every Disney film made. It's colonized every cultural form. Now, individually, all those ads are pretty innocent. Collectively, they are deeply political. I mean, if you think about this, some of the two big issues of our age, which are climate change and the global terms of trade, advertising has a pretty clear position on both. Yeah, don't worry. Everything is fine. You have to worry about how this was produced. Not relevant. Really not relevant. Nothing to do with you. Just enjoy the moment of consumption. And anyway, you know, production is this sort of happy group of people that you might see. This Italian family making pasta or whatever it is. Deeply political discourse, but we don't recognise it as such. And I think we need to begin to do that. We need to begin to realise that advertising is political and that we might begin to think about, one, reducing its presence in our lives, and two, some kind of right of reply. You know, maybe on television. I was at a conference actually a couple of weeks ago where I was talking to people in the television industry, and I said, well, maybe you should make a few more programmes that put the other side of the case. Because at the moment, it's a one-sided conversation. Now, all that cultural activity makes it very hard for us to think about other ways of progressing, because we are told over and over again that progress, that happiness, that solutions to every problem lies in one place alone, and that is through the consumption of objects. So it's very hard to imagine other ways of doing things. The third thing I want to talk about is what I call disposable news. Now, the news media is in many ways a kind of counterpoint to advertising. Now, advertising clearly is bound up with consumption. The news media is a space not for consumerism potentially, but for citizenship. It's about making us better citizens so that we can operate in a democracy in a way that is informed, that we can take history even into our own hands if we wish. If you look at the growth of news over the last several hundred years, there are two competing notions that you get that in the news industry. One of them is a very democratic notion, that news is all about democracy, all about making us well informed. It's all about challenging conventional wisdom. The other is a very different idea, and it emerged at precisely that moment when news became a commodity. And that is this, that in order to make news profitable, you've got to make it short-lived. And so you get the sort of ultimate expression of built-in obsolescence, which is the newspaper. Here is an object that becomes obsolescent within a day. Yeah, I've just read it, so let's throw it out, get the next one tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow. And the very phrase, yesterday's news, implies that if it happened yesterday, then it's of no relevance to anything. Now, that's a very effective business model, and it created the idea in our heads that the meaning of news was all to do with it being up to date, to do with it being current, an idea that has reached its apotheosis in the 24-hour news channels, where it's all about the latest, the current. It's, you know, its currency, if you like, is its currency. It's about being instantaneous and up-to-date. Now, the first of those two notions, the idea that news is all about democracy, about questioning conventional wisdom, would imply that news is a space where we can talk about the things I've been talking about today. The second of those ideas makes it much more difficult to talk about that, because in many ways, it's a model of news that becomes the embodiment of a kind of business model of built-in obsolescence, so it's not likely to question it. We did a study of this. We did a study of newspapers in the US and the UK, where we looked at how newspapers were covering the issue of economic growth. And, I mean, one of the things I've tried to do today is to talk about how controversial, in many ways, economic growth should be. How, in many ways, there are all sorts of aspects to economic growth that are troubling, that means it should be a subject of debate. And we wanted to see how much of that was expressed in newspapers. We found, and you won't be surprised by this, that it, on the whole, was not. In 95% of occasions, economic growth was represented as an objective good. So it wasn't neutral coverage that just said, well, here's economic growth and here's some facts about it. It was coverage that said, economic growth is a good thing, we need more of it. If we don't have more of it, then that's bad. Doesn't matter what form it takes, we just want more of it. So consumption is good. It doesn't matter even if it's based on debt. We want more of it. So our news media, which perhaps could be the space in which we're debating these things, is actually a space in which we're replicating the same ideas. So what I want to suggest is that what we need to do, if we're going to think about other forms of progress, is to create more imaginative space. We need to change the way governments operate. Currently, governments intervene to support consumer capitalism, to sustain it and to limit its externalities, based on a model of built-in obsolescence. We could do something very different. We could say to companies, actually, you've got to pay for the cost of the disposal of the things you produce. We could even go further and say, we're not going to subsidise your waste disposal. We're going to subsidise a different group of people. We're going to subsidise those people whose job it is to fix things. I mean, remember them? You know, remember the time when, you know, you had an electronic device and it broke, you could take it to a place and they would fix it. You know, that seems like, you know, a bygone age. But, you know, if you subsidise that industry and you made the cost of production the true cost of production, then maybe you would get a different way of producing things that focused less on their sort of temporal nature and more on the need for them to endure. A second thing we need to do is to treat advertising as political. I mean, imagine for a moment, you know, that whole world of advertising. Imagine if you told every advertiser tomorrow, you said, OK, as of tomorrow, you can tell any story you like. Anything. It could be about, you know, your pet gerbil or, you know, the day that you went for a walk in the woods. It can be about anything. Our entire cultural environment will be transformed because we would not be getting endless stories about the same thing, which is consumption. We'd be getting lots of different stories about all kinds of different things. What we should begin to do is try and think about how we might make that more possible. And that means limiting the space of ads rather than ever increasing it. Governments, on the whole, over the last 20 years or so, have created more and more space for advertising. They need to think about creating less space for advertising, but also to think about creating media that might begin to offer other points of view. And finally, I think we need what you might call a slow news movement. You know, we had a slow food movement that there was a kind of rebellion against mass-produced fast food that really wasn't very good for you. We need a movement that's a rebellion against mass-produced fast news that really doesn't tell you very much. We need news that endures. The idea that actually there was something that happened yesterday that still has meaning, that's still useful for us to know. And we need to embrace a different notion of newness in news. I mean, news says that it embraces the new. Actually, it only embraces the new in a very superficial sense. It embraces the new in the idea that it happened recently. It doesn't embrace new ideas, particularly. We need a news media that begins to do that. And once we start to do those things, then maybe we can imagine a world in which maybe we still have consumer capitalism, but we don't afford it quite the pride of place that it has now, And maybe we can think in the 21st century about other kinds of progress. Thank you.
You were just listening to Justin Lewis on consumer capitalism. This classic from the AR archives was recorded at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts. Justin Lewis is professor of communication at the School of Journalism at Cardiff University in the UK. He's the author of many books and articles on capitalism, media, and politics. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Kuhan Pakmander, Francesca Albanese, Naomi Klein, Chris Hedges, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Justin Lewis on Consumer Capitalism, and for Noam Chomsky's latest book, The Myth of American Idealism, How U.S. Policy Endangers the World, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.